Good. No, don't
okay.
have to worry about that.
Good.
So, well, for the recording's sake, we'll tell everyone that these conversations are recorded and they are posted on the Brownfields toolbox. And do you want to give that web address? Hello?
Yeah, I can do that.
And at that web address, we've got recordings for all 34 sessions at this point. And
the written notes.
And we could have, you could go to the notes and check the notes, and then if you want to listen to the discussion, you can go and listen to the MP3s.
Yeah.
So that website is, that website's building up really nice.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I was kind of surprised that, you know, when we got those notifications that it was messed up going to the Nahant webpage. I mean, that happened within a matter of hours.
Wow.
That some of our people notified us, two of them, one to you and one to me.
Yeah, that was really
within a short amount of time of it going down. So that tells us that people are using it.
People are.
And one of them was an EPA person that did that. So I thought
very
that was pretty cool.
Very neat. I think that the fact that they've got it on their site and referring people to it is great. And they also seem to be referring people to the PLC because I think this week we had about three people that were referred.
Yeah, right.
So the I think that's a good thing. The and you're going to give everyone an update on the EPA RFP.
I will.
Schedule.
I will.
Okay,
I just hope that I sent all the links and passwords.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Glow. Who's this?
Hey, Glow. This is Daniel from North Star, Hartford, Connecticut.
Hey, Daniel. How are you?
Good. How's everything? How you been?
Good. Trying to keep warm.
Imagine you guys are...
What?
So you guys are getting snowed in up there, huh?
Well, we're not snowed in. I mean, it takes a lot for us to get snowed in, but we are
Iowans.
Supposed to get another 5 inches this afternoon, so.
Those Iowans, they get, you know, only 3 feet of snow. What the heck? I've been in Minnesota, though, and I've been on the road when I, all of a sudden I looked in the rearview mirror, and I see this, these huge monster trucks coming down with these angled, you know, angled plows, and they're just going down the street about 40 miles an hour, and you get out of their way, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And they throw that snow. You'd hate to be standing on the sidewalk when they hit.
Hi, who just joined us?
This is Susan Almano from the Merrimack Valley WIB.
Hi, Susan. Glad you could join us today.
Thank you. Me too.
Susan, it's always good to have WIB people with us.
Yeah, we hope so.
WIBs have become a very important part of Brownfields, and we're so much involved in job training.
Hi.
Uh-huh.
Joined us.
Hi, this is Hope Botterbush from Clearwater, Florida, Pinellas Technical Education Centers.
Good. I'm glad you can join us.
Thank
we're
you.
Really jealous. Now, you're getting some cold weather down there, Hope, right?
Oh, my God. I mean, it's just the worst that we've had in decades.
Goodness.
How bad is it?
Well, we were in the 30s tonight, and it's supposed to be 29 tonight. So, I mean, those are record-breaking temperatures for us. But then by the end of the week, it'll be 70 again.
We can only dream of 29 here in Iowa.
Someone's
joined us. Who joined us?
This is Jim Gordon, Fireball, California.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hey, Jim.
Say, I'm just wondering, down there in Florida, do people have heating in their houses?
Oh, yeah, we have central heat now. Yes.
Good, thank heavens. I was thinking it would be terrible without any heat.
Yeah, it certainly is. But there are a lot of people who don't have heat. They have to go to shelters or they run gas heaters or whatever, kerosene heaters.
Right, wow.
A lot of fire.
Yeah.
It's interesting that weatherization in Florida is more for the summer than it is the winter.
Yeah. That's for sure. But, yeah, we have to have central heat and air, and most of the time we never have the heat on, but I have the air on most of the year. Not this week.
No, it doesn't sound like it.
You're not getting a lot of sympathy from most of us because we're...
yeah, I know. I'm sorry. It's all relative, isn't it?
I guess.
Jean Marie Crockett, Santa Fe Community College.
Sorry, I didn't catch your first name.
Jean Marie.
Oh, hi, Jean. How are you?
Fine. Hi.
Okay.
We've been talking about, we've got people all over the country, and you're in Santa Fe, so you're not getting cold weather out there, are you? What's the climate in New Mexico this time of the year? Is it cold?
It's variable. It was 54 degrees when I left home today, and we may get snow tonight.
Wow. So you're warmer than Florida.
Hi, who just joined us?
Jared Taylor, Youthville, Louisville.
Okay, how are you?
Been very well. A little cold, but pretty well otherwise.
Good.
Yeah, we've been talking to everyone about their climates, and it kind of ties into our program. In Florida, it's freezing. The poor people are losing their citrus crop, and then we've got poor Glo there in Iowa. And she's snowed in. And
I'm not snowed in.
No, that's right.
Cold.
You never get snowed in. And Santa Fe, I'm in North Carolina, and we're in the 20s. It's cold here. They were afraid of frost, so they started salting the roads because of frost. Because no one knows how to drive down here. That's the common thing. Everyone.
I got my Blizzak tires now. I can go anywhere.
Well, why don't we get started? And there'll be probably people joining us. One of the things we want to talk about two general areas. We want to talk some more about certifications. We kind of left them off last time, and then we want to go on and talk a little bit more about this green curriculum. Before we start, Glo, do you want to give us an update on the latest from EPA? You talked to the people there just this week.
Yeah, actually, I just talked to them yesterday and asked them about the release of the job training RFP. He tells me now that, and this is quote, it better be out by the end of the week.
Okay.
So, I mean, you guys all know where to look for it, right, on the EPA Brownfields webpage. And then I will try to get that out on the listservs, both listservs.
Yeah. You'll probably get it. You'll probably get it from a bunch of us. I'll send a copy to everyone on the PLC list.
Okay, that'd be good. And I'll put it out on both of the listservs. But I would be looking at the EPA page, too, just in case, because usually headquarters notifies me the day that it's released, even sometimes a little bit before the actual time that it's released. If by chance they don't do that, you can always look on their web to see it.
Good.
Are they talking about extending the due date?
You know, I've asked that question several times, and that's one question that they have not answered. And they have to, I would think. But I don't see it. They have not answered me on that question, so I can't say for sure.
What we've been concerned about is EPA has never been early on anything, and they're traditionally a month or two late on everything they do. The problem we're concerned with, we're going to have to address after this RFP is issued, is if they delay the due date too long and they delay the review date, then it becomes a cycle issue of when your first cycle might start. And, you know, then they're just going to end up at the worst time where these won't be awarded till the fall or near the end of the summer. So it'll obviate having a session this summer, and that would then... you would probably start sessions so your graduates could get involved in next spring, you know, so for placing in the spring. It's hard to place at this time of the year because there just isn't a lot of activity. It depends on your climate, of course. But for those in the winter climates, it's a little tougher to place this time of the year. So as soon as this comes out, we're going to have to look at that and get those dates. We'll have to talk to Joe about when he expects the review panels to be evaluating them and then when, how long it'll take for them to actually give the awards. But we'll keep you all up informed on that.
Hi, did someone just join us?
David.
Hi.
Hi, David.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, Dave.
Hi, I'm also late joining as well. I apologize for that. I'm Ray Champ with the Black City Community College up in Browning, Montana.
Oh, great. Thank you.
You also have Sarah Playland and Marie Price here from North Idaho College.
Okay.
Now, if you haven't sent me your email list, email address, if you could send it, just get your email to me, mikesenyu@aol.com. And that's, it's the address is msenew@aol.com. That's M as in Michael, S as in Sam, ENEW@AOL.com. If you're not on our list, just send me your email because we send out announcements and post-session notes. And if I've either got your email incorrect or it's hard to say if you don't get a notice from me, write me. But if you send that to me, I'll make sure you get post-session notes and announcements and things like that.
Well, and excellent. The other thing is that everybody that's on Mike's distribution list for this PLC also gets added to the listserv, and by doing that, you will receive the notifications from me when APA releases the RFP. That's an important piece.
Right. So what we wanted to talk about today was a little bit more about certifications and about the green curriculum and kind of an update of where you should be now and what you should be doing now regarding the grant. Last session, we talked about what people are offering in their certifications. And one of the things that I had mentioned in the post-session notes is one approach in this whole process is, of course, the most important thing is a needs assessment to determine what type of people are needed in your community. And that's going to vary from place to place. Clearly, Hope's area down in Florida may be quite different than Glow's area in Iowa and might be different than someone in Santa Fe or in Chicago. So there will be some basic things that are in common with everyone, but then there's going to be differences on the margin. One of the things that we're going to find out when the RFP is issued, they do require that everyone offer the 40-hour wayside worker, HAZWOPR, we call it, 1910-120. It's an OSHA standard, and it requires a certification. Anyone who goes on to a site that has hazardous materials needs to have one of these certifications. So that's kind of a no-brainer. You have to offer that with or without any kind of a needs assessment. They were also asking for RRMP, which is a lead renovation, repair, and painting certification. That's issued by EPA. That may or may not be required. We're going to see when the RFP comes out. The reason is they feel a lot of places there are lead issues. Again, in Florida, there may or may not be some newer communities. So we'll see if that's going to be a required certification that everyone has to have. After those two required certifications, then there's going to be a lot of optional ones. And this will be dependent on your needs assessment. But most people are offering a 10-hour. Now, there's a general industry safety and health, or there's a general construction safety and health. That's about 10 hours. Many of the programs offer those. There's a 30-hour general construction industry, general construction certification, and there's a 30-hour general industry. So there's a 10 and a 30-hour certificate, either for a general industry or for construction, general construction. So that's something you may want to consider depending on if your program is construction-oriented or general industry-oriented. Many people are offering confined space entry. This is an OSHA certification that if you're going to go if you're working with air conditioners or going into confined spaces on hazardous materials, you may need to have a confined space certification. Some, if they're involved in solar, might be doing electrical safety, which, or if they're involved with wind, they might be doing safety and scaffolding. These are OSHA certifications. Fall and arrest to the systems is another certification. So those will depend on your specific area of interest in your community, whether you're going to be offering an environmental program or you're going to be offering more something oriented towards solar or wind or something like that. You might, if you're going to stay in the EPA arena, there's asbestos certs and radon certs. You might be involved in that. And there are other types of certifications, such as first aid, that you might be giving everyone. Most people will be offering a first aid certificate. Many of our programs in urban areas are offering commercial driver's license. They find that a lot of their participants need to be able to drive a truck and have a commercial driver's license. So, and if their program is oriented towards transportation, they may need DOT regs, or they may need first responder, some sort of first responder training. So last week, I think we kind of went through the, some asked different people some of these that they offer. And do any of you want to offer a kind of run through a quick list of your offerings in terms of the certs?
Yeah, I guess I'll chime in here. This is Daniel from North Star in Hartford. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Okay. I'll go through a quick. Of course, you know, like all brownfields, we're offering the two license in lead and asbestos, mm-hmm. Which are the main, you know, the main focal points. But then we also this cycle added mold and mold inspection. We also added the RRP certificate. Of course, we also added as well the environmental greening certificate, or as well as we're doing a side program for wastewater management, which is going on for a selected few of our grads that we felt could really grasp and run with the material. So that's one. The big one, of course, the OSHA 10 card. Some programs didn't offer the OSHA 10, but when we sit down with our panel to talk about employment opportunities, the OSHA 10 card is what's needed to actually hop on any site at all, as well as your HAZOPA 40. And some programs didn't offer that, but we decided to offer that within our program for this cycle. And we also did a certificate for phase one and phase two. So that kind of gives people a leg up on how to actually go in and handle a site. So those are some new things that we added to our program.
That's interesting. The interesting things here, your OSHA 10 card, is that you're talking about general construction or general industry?
That's right, because what we came up with, sorry to cut you off, what we came up with was that before you get to the asbestos, you got to do a demo.
Right.
And that's where that comes in handy.
Exactly. And we talked last week about forklift even and some people, but as Glo had mentioned last time, you have to, the employer really has to brief you on a certificate because of insurance companies, the forklift operators. But we find that, you know, those peripheral licenses give people a head up sometimes, whether it's a commercial driver's license, OSHA 10, or forklift operators are handy. They're not, none of those are environmental per se, but they're handy things that they're peripheral to the program that you need. We might briefly tell people about phase one and phase two. Whenever you have an area that might be a brownfield or a contaminated site, you have to have a phase one first and a phase two, and some communities require phase ones be done. And the difference between a phase one and a phase two is basically a phase one is a paper search. If there's a piece of property that, say, someone's going to buy a piece of property they might do a phase one, which you'd go down to the city hall and you check records to see, aha, there was a lead paint factory on that property at one point, or there was a battery plant on that property in the early 20s, you know, and now it's all just fields, and there's no one would ever know. But when you go back, you all of a sudden you found out that there was some industrial activity on that property that should trigger alarms. And at that point, that may put a kibosh on the whole transaction, or it may lead to a phase two, where you're actually now going in and digging test wells, and you're what we call characterizing the site to see what pollutants are there and what are the concentrations of those pollutants. Are there any plume forms when people say we had a dry cleaning plant and they kept dumping their solvents out the back door, and over 20 years they built up a plume of pollutants where the pollutant just went into the ground, and then plumes usually move towards water. So if there's a stream or lake nearby, all of a sudden you start seeing this like a smokestack, but it's in the ground. It's a plume of pollution going right for that space. So the phase two is going to characterize where the pollutants are and the extent of those pollutants. And now phase twos have to be performed by engineers, but even though they're performed by engineers, they need helpers. And there's a lot of work for our people doing test wells and sampling and analysis and that type of thing. Is that pretty much what your workers are going to be doing up there, Daniel?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah.
With a lot of city projects, they have to go back, especially, I'm not sure if a lot of other states are doing this, but especially a lot of city projects and state projects, they're trying to they're trying to hold the let's say when they go and do renovation work or remediation work, they want to maintain the same look of the building in terms of let's say if it was built in the 1800s. So sometimes in order to match the look of the building, it's certain things they can't demo. So some of their research is actually to find out what they can demo or destroy, they can't. And some of that research goes within, again, that phase one or phase two. Even, like I said, even when it comes to the property, if they want to build a park in the back, and at one time there was a garage there that was built in the 1800s that was demolished in, let's say, the early 60s, that made a lot of debris in that ground may have been left over with issues of PCB or whatever, you know, issues are there to remediate. So some research needs to be done before you take that next step, and you're absolutely right. A lot of our students are learning that, and they're applying it now to the real world.
That's great. There was a time. The nice thing about phase ones is if one of the things I've suggested is defining your target group first, your participant group, and working backwards in terms of the certifications and the courses you're going to be offering. To give you an example of this, we had a program that was interested in targeting veterans, disabled veterans. Well, one might say off the top of your head, we can't use disabled veterans in remediation because they can't get around, they can't, you know, we could train them, but then they couldn't get jobs. But then all of a sudden, if you work backwards and you say, well, what could disabled vets work do really well? Well, phase ones are perfect because they get dressed up, they go down to City Hall, they're comfortable in an environment of government, people around them. They get to search literature searches. They learn to access records, and they become extremely valuable. And there are states that are requiring phase ones, and you actually have to be licensed to do phase ones. So there's an opportunity for them to work in realtor offices. So here's a perfect example of how you can work backward from your target group and then give people skills that make them highly employable to fit those needs. We've also indicated that if your target group, say, are going to be pregnant women, for example, you're going to have to be careful on the jobs that you're training them for so that they can qualify when they graduate to be able to do those jobs. You wouldn't want them to be doing perhaps asbestos removal or something like that. So there's the number one thing you have to do is a needs assessment, and we always hammer needs assessment. Do that first to find out what types of industry, what types of jobs. And I think Daniel, here's a perfect example. You kind of ran through a quick needs assessment of in your community. You've got some historic communities that you're going to be reviving, and so there's a need for jobs there. So your needs assessment determines where you might be able to place people. And then, two, you go back to your target group and say, okay, what kind of people are we going to be training, and can we place those people in those jobs? And then the third question is, well, what kind of training do we have to give them? And we earlier just ran through this very long list of this list of certs that we'll put on the post-session notes of the different types of training you can provide. But you're kind of, as you see what we're doing, we're building up your program first with needs, then with target group, and then with what kind of skills and knowledges can we give them that will get them those jobs from your needs assessment. So we're kind of working backwards. The other, and I think it sounds, Daniel, like you've done that in an informal way in that you've altered your program based on the needs you've seen as in your community. It sounded like you've added some things as you saw the need developing in your community for those jobs, which is great.
That's absolutely correct. We again, feedback from our employers as well as industry experts with upcoming things that were coming up, let's say like the RRP certificate, as well as feedback from actual our previous cycles, you know, trying to find placement for them, trying to find work for those guys, and coming up with roadblocks. So every cycle we try to improve so that it'll lessen the barrier of entry for employment for a lot of our grads.
Right. One thing I want to talk a little bit about briefly, and we'll probably talk about it more, is one of the things that may come out in this RFP is they're going to want you to do training in a whole number of areas. And we just rattled off a whole lot of certifications. You might say, well, I've only got limited time, and I can only provide a certain number of courses. So how the heck am I going to do all these things that EPA wants me to do and then also do the things I have to do for my community? And what we might throw out as a suggestion is the word green curriculum. And we talked about this the last time a little bit, but I'd like to expand a little bit about it. You can offer a 40-hour green technology. And, of course, the question is, what does green mean? And pretty much everything. It can involve issues involving media, which is air, water, solid waste, urban agriculture, radiation, all of the pollutant medias. It could involve remediation, which is cleaning up the pollutants in all those areas. It could include monitoring, sampling, and analysis, which means characterizing what those pollutants are and how bad they are there. So you can use a 40-hour green curriculum, and it could also include things like conservation. So the three R's are reuse, recycle, and reduce your pollutants. So you can use a 40-hour green technology curriculum to pick up all of the things that you are not going to be able to teach in your certification and specific courses and put them all into your green curriculum and then address all of these issues. So, in fact, in your RFP, when you're writing that, you want to make sure that everything they ask you to address, you do address. And this green curriculum may be a good, and I'm just posing this, not saying you need to do this, but it's just a possibility of coming up with a green curriculum that would be a catch-all for all the things you're not covering in your basic courses. And in your RFP, if you indicate those things that you are training in your green curriculum, you won't be able to be docked points for not talking about solid waste, for example. They might say, well, you've got a nice proposal, but you didn't mention anything about urban agriculture, or you didn't talk about waste sites, or you didn't talk about wastewater or stormwater. And you can basically point out the fact that, oh, yes, you are training in those areas. It's in your green curriculum. And so one of the things you may want to start thinking about is, in talking to your trainers, is do you have some sort of a green technology course in your offering to pick up some of these other issues? Anyone out there have a green curriculum right now? Some sort of a green curriculum?
We have several versions of green curriculum here. We do all kinds of things here. We're opening up a sustainable technology center, and we have several certificate programs.
So you actually have you might have several different concentrations in green, whether it's has to do with energy or conservation or environmental.
Right. And we also have like green facilities management and, you know, wind power, and we also have a biofuels program, and we just have a whole variety of different certificate programs and some associates programs.
One thing regarding the EPA job training proposal, they're going to be focusing primarily, they like to see what environmental courses you've got. So while it's important to do the conservation, which is the weatherization and the LEEDs and all of those, you may want to relate back to the environmental programs, how these are environmentally oriented. And we've had this discussion before of it might not be advisable, for example, to do everything in conservation and LEEDs and weatherization and then not do anything in environment, because it is an EPA grant, which EPA is charged with characterizing the environment, figuring out what pollution levels are and cleaning it up. And so, you know, conservation is good in that it's a secondary impact. It has a secondary impact on environment, but it isn't a primary impact, as like emissions would be. So when you start moving into those LEEDs, you want to make sure you do relate it back to the energy environment part of it. Well, very good. Well, we'll write some of these things up in the post-session notes. And those of you who are getting your grant proposals together, we'll also come up with the list of where you should be now. And clearly, hopefully all of you have contacted your regional coordinator. And if you haven't, you need to do it this week before this RFP comes out. And in the session notes, and we put them in last session notes, we've got the 10 regional coordinators with their phone numbers, and you need to call them and just tell them that you're planning on submitting a proposal, and you wanted to just touch base with them, and any help they can give you would be appreciated. And they can't help you after the RFP comes out. So one of the top things on your list this week is just touch base with them and let them know you're going to be submitting. And even if it turns out you don't submit, just touch base with them and tell them that you're really interested. This is important. It gets you on their radar screen, and it lets them know that you're interested in this program. You got to continue your needs assessment, contacting the governmental organizations with your plans, potential employers, local environmental coordinators. You've got to start seeing what jobs are out there, the types of jobs. You also need to, at this point, keep expanding your support network. You need to find out who your friends are and who's willing to support you. Again, it might feel a little funny that you haven't gotten the grant yet, but you're planning on it, and I think you need to act as if you're going to get the grant. You need to go out and start talking to people about being on your advisory committees and getting their support, because the more you could show in your grant proposal in terms of assistance, the better off you're going to be. And if you can get involved in a public hearing, you document it, so because you're going to be able to use it in your proposal. So you can, if there's any chance that there's going to be a public hearing, see if you can get even a couple of minutes to announce that you're intending on submitting a job development proposal. And then you can put that in your proposal that you participated in a public hearing about your intents. And that goes a long way in terms of getting additional points in terms of working with your community. So all of these things you need to start doing now. And I know this is a downtime between now and January, but it's a good thing to start thinking about. And
you know, Mike, I want to. Can I make a comment? This is G.
Sure.
Marie.
Sure.
The continuous postponement of the release has really put a lot of us at a disadvantage because of the political cycle. A lot of the contacts and the relationships we have established are going to disappear with the change of administrations. And so I'm forced with having to I'm waiting for the new people in a lot of the government agencies to be appointed by our new governor. It's a whole new slate come January 1 for us in New Mexico. And some of our congressional people are changing. So EPA has really done us all a disservice by pushing this out into the transition period.
That's a very interesting comment. That is interesting. And we'll share it with some of the people at EPA just in general in terms of, you know, there is that people out there are trying to, we've encouraged them to make contacts, and you're exactly right. City managers may change all the way down the line, and you're going to have to reestablish new contacts in many cases. A very interesting point here, and it's going to require going out. One possible advantage might be that if you're into the new office on a new employee, could become his favorite project. In other words, if you're in there early and you've got your feet on the ground here, he's got to start showing all kinds of things that he's doing and supporting. And if he could jump onto a job program early in his administration, it could be a very positive thing for him. So it could be. There is a potential for that working to your advantage, but it does require more work on your part. That's right. For example, if you were to walk into a city manager's office and tell him you intend to apply for that, all of a sudden the bells are going to start ringing in his mind. I could be in here for 3 months and bring in a grant to my community, and this could be a real positive thing for him, and it might end up with some additional support for you. So,
And that's why I'm very concerned that we're not going to have 90 days.
Right.
If they release it this week, it couldn't be a worse time. Our school closes down on Friday for Christmas break.
Yeah, you're going to lose almost a month. You're right.
Right. Timing couldn't be worse.
Yeah, we'll express that to them, and hopefully they've extended this out a few months. And that brings up a good point for us. Our next session, our little 30 minutes, we're going to have to end this, but our next session will be in January. It'll be January 5th after vacation. So the community college is shut down. So we're going to be we'll be sending you some email. But our next little 30-minute call will be January 5th, Wednesday at 2 p.m. So I'll send everyone out some notes. If you have not gotten correspondence from me, send me your email contact information so we make sure that you get some session notes and you get the RFP, and anything we send out to everyone you'll get. Okay? So with that, we'll let everyone go get back to their work and have a great break here, and Merry Christmas. And
would you repeat your email once more?
Yes, it's msenew@aol.com, and that's spelled msenew. msenew@aol.com.
Thank you very much.
Just shoot that out to me, and we'll make sure you get on this list. And you all have a great holiday, and we'll see you January 5th. Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, no.